the House Committee on Human Services on February 4th, 2011. And I'm going to open up an informational hearing from the Department of Human Services. And Erin Kelly Field is with us again. And are you bringing up anyone with you now, or are you just going to...
Co-chairs Tomei and William, good morning. Erin Kelly Seal for the record. Yes, Stephanie Parrish is going to join me first. We appreciate the opportunity to continue the conversation about the Children, Adults, and Families Division and keep giving you, we gave you a brief overview of what we do on Wednesday. And today, we're going to spend a little time diving deeper into two of our major program areas. The first is our employment program for persons with disabilities in the Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services. That'll be followed by an overview of our child welfare programs, which will precede several bills you're hearing relating to child welfare. So hopefully that'll be helpful to sequence in that way. So I just want to introduce Stephanie Parrish Taylor. She's the administrator of our Office of Vocational Rehabilitation Services, which we default to calling Voc Rehab or OVRS, so forgive us if we don't say the whole name repeatedly in the interest of time. So thank you. Can you introduce yourself for the record?
Good morning, Co-Chairs Tomei and Gilliam. For the record, my name is Stephanie Parrish Taylor.
Thank you for joining us, Stephanie. And from now on, you just need to say chairs. We're tired of this COVID.
Okay. Disability impacts Oregonians. Nearly a 500,000 Oregonians of working age experience a disability. A 250,000 working age individuals receive Social Security disability benefits. 12.5% of Oregonians with disabilities live at or below the poverty level, which is about $22,000 annually for a family of four. 36.6% of youth with disabilities drop out of school, compared to 12% of students without disabilities. About 30% of parents accessing temporary assistance for needy families for benefits and job supports experience disabilities. Roughly 171,000 people who experience a severe and persistent mental illness want to work. Additionally, about 10% of working age individuals who experience a disability express an interest for work. But a number of those folks aren't in the labor market. They've given up hope. So there are actually more than that who want to go to work. The Office of Vocational Rehabilitation's mission is to assist those Oregonians with disabling conditions whose functional limitations present barriers to employment and who require services from us to secure that employment. We look to make sure it is consistent with their strengths, interests, and abilities. We accomplish this by having our counselors develop individualized plans for employment and for purchasing goods and services and trainings that address their barriers to employment. We serve all Oregonians who are legal to work, including youth who are transitioning from special education to post-secondary work or schooling.
Could I just make one point here? I think one of the things that is unique about OVRS services within the Children, Adults, and Families Division, as compared to the self-sufficiency programs, is there is no income determination with respect to qualifying for the program. So I just wanted to make that different. That point is as how it's different from our Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, which has income eligibility requirements as well as other requirements in order to participate. So we'll talk a little bit later about some of the ways that we have had to manage the program because we haven't had enough resource to meet the need. And there are, this is a federally driven program, and so we receive money from the federal government in the form of a grant to administer the program. Relatively speaking, and I can get you the percentage, the state contribution to the program is very, very small. It's enough to basically meet our maintenance of effort requirement. And again, this is a program in our division which federal rules really dominate and drive. So I just wanted to make that point about the income eligibility issue, and really, you know, any individual who is able to work and has a disability is able to access OVRS services when there is the resource to accommodate those needs. Going the wrong direction, sorry.
In 2010, we served 15,234 individuals, developed 3,035 individual plans for employment, resulting in 1,177 employment outcomes. These individuals earned an average of $11.38 per hour and worked an average of 27 hours a week. We partner with 120 local school districts to run the youth transition program. Across the state, we served approximately 1,200 students, assisting them to transition from special education classes to work, school, or a combination of the two. 90% of those students who participated in the program went on, in comparison to that earlier national average. And at a year later, 70% of those kids continued to be engaged in either school or employment. Supported employment is a program that we run for individuals with the most significant disabilities. We assisted 17 community mental health programs implement individualized placement and support, which is an evidence-based supported employment model. 199 individuals with severe and persistent mental illness were served. 81 obtained employment outcomes. Additionally, we partner with seniors and people with disabilities to serve 581 individuals with developmental disabilities. 269 obtained employment outcome. Aaron referenced that we serve people as long as we have funds available. In January of 2009, we entered into an order of selection because we lack sufficient resources to serve all of the individuals requesting our assistance. What the order means is that we have to prioritize eligible individuals based on the severity of their disability. Those with the most significant disabilities are prioritized first. People who we cannot serve are placed on a statewide wait list by the date of application and their priority level. For us, it meant that we placed 4,600 people on a statewide waiting list. We did provide information and referral for those individuals to assist them to look at other resources. In June of 2009, we began to remove priority one individuals from our wait list. And by August of 2010, we were able to serve all priority levels.
And may I just interrupt here for a moment? I think this is really a credit to Stephanie and her team across the state as evidence to me of their ability to effectively manage their resources such that they were able to remove everyone from the wait list, even though going into the biennium, we were forecasting such a significant caseload that we had to implement this. It's a federal tool to manage your caseload, basically, against your budget reality. And so we were able, before the end of the biennium, to begin serving everyone on all priority levels, and everyone came off the wait list, which was a real accomplishment for the program.
While she stopped, can I ask
one? Yes.
Since we stopped for a second, I want to go back to what, with this slide and what you interrupted a minute ago about income is not a factor, correct? But I understand, and I'm glad that it's the severity of the disability that's is how you prioritize. But you must have to. There must be some economic factor involved. Those that can pay, can't pay, don't have income. Is it just by law you can't, or by virtue of the way you have to prioritize?
We did institute a number of years ago a financial means test, and it's a graduated scale. We exclude TANF recipients, SSI and SSD recipients. I believe veterans are excluded. People on receiving food stamps or SNAP benefits are excluded. And then for those folks who do have income that meets a certain threshold, we do ask them to participate in the cost of their plan, and there's a percentage of the cost that's linked to their particular income.
Okay, that makes more sense. Thank you.
Do you want to go through that? I think this next, I interrupted you, but I do want to make sure, members of the committee, that this particular set of data gets discussed. It's the demographic information, and I think it's really important to note, because one of the things that we have done in the past is begun to chart, you know, who in these programs are being served. And I think most significantly, this program's current services are being driven by individuals with psychiatric and cognitive disabilities. And I think, you know, perceptually, from an external perspective, I think people most often think of the influence of this program with respect to people who have a physical disability. And there are significant supports for people with physical disabilities in the program. But the single largest drivers of the caseload increases in the program over the last 4 years that we've been tracking have really been the issues of psychiatric and cognitive disabilities. And so to the point earlier about some of the individuals who are most difficult to support becoming gainfully employed, the program's had to really change its strategy with respect to serving those individuals, because different kinds of supports obviously are needed for someone who's struggling with a severe and persistent mental illness or for someone with a developmental disability. The other myth to debunk around this, however, is that those folks can be employed, are employed, and are working and contributing members of our communities. And so it's been a major change, I think, for the program. Some things you've also been hearing about contribute to this, things like autism, brain injury, different kinds of disability that impacts individuals who either have an employment history or who are young people coming out of schools. And that's why we've really been shifting the program in its strategies around the youth transition, its strategies around some of the more hard-to-serve folks who do struggle with psychiatric or cognitive disabilities. So just thought I would make a note about the population that's driving this and its demographics.
Co-chair, or yes, co-chair,
yeah,
whoever asked a good question. But also, I remember that you were very interested in folks with brain injuries.
Yes,
I remember from the past. So you mentioned that those are folks too. And I think what we heard in previous hearings was that there is a growing number of people who have been identified with brain injuries, and how difficult it is for some of these folks both to get an education and also to get and hold a job. So could we talk a little bit about that?
Okay. I've actually served on the Governor's Brain Injury Task Force, you're right, there's a great concern about youth in particular who've experienced brain injury and are undiagnosed. Sometimes those children will appear in our program. We're in a position to provide the assessment that will often identify those brain injuries. But in the adult population, we certainly see it. We anticipate seeing more as the veterans mm-hmm. from the Iraqi and Afghani wars return. One of the things that we've done in partnership with the Brain Injury Association here in Oregon and our independent living centers are provide a kit. It includes a number of tools that help brain injury people schedule their days, keep track of their appointments, in their activities. We also have a brain train program that's operated out of the Central Oregon Independent Living Center. We will provide, based on what the functional limitations are, a host of things. Brain injury can go from a person who has mobility issues, cognitive issues, behavioral issues, to someone who has memory issues. The range and the impact mm-hmm. is quite broad. And our program, because of its individualized nature, can assess what those limitations are and then to begin to build strategies or arrange services or training that would help that person on a very individualized basis match to a particular employment outcome.
That's terrific, and I think we are both very pleased that you're working so intently with these people and recognizing what a huge issue this is and are preparing to help them. Thank you so much.
Just one quick addition to that is I'm sure you know the folks at the Oregon Brain Injury Association, Sherry Stock. I wanted to be sure that you knew who they were. Good.
Yeah.
Yes, I just have, I'm wondering whether that information, you said that you had information regarding how people with brain injuries might be able to handle the day-to-day kinds of things. Is that available online? Where is that available? Only in a printed form, or do you have to go to one of the groups?
Representative Frederick. Probably the richest source of that information is the Brain Injury Association of Oregon website. One of the things that the Governor's Task Force is looking at is how to get information out to the public, both about what brain injury looks like and the resources that are available.
So it's the Brain Injury Association of Oregon?
Yes.
And co-chairs, Representative Frederick, we'd be happy to email you a link to that website
like that,
so you
please.
Don't need to look for that. We'll follow up with that information.
Thank you so much. Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At the Autism Commission last week, there was some talk about the role of voc rehab, particularly in the transition from folks on the spectrum from school to adult life. And could you talk a little bit about, have you been able to focus on that area a little bit? Where's that area going? How is it affecting you?
You want to talk about the project access over the next
If you could turn to page 6, Project Access is a 5-year federally funded grant that we received from the Rehabilitation Services Administration to develop a new service delivery model for youth in transition. And one of our goals in doing that is to broaden our bandwidth around the disabilities that we serve for youth in transition. We have a program that really targets young people with mild mental retardation and learning disabilities, but we wanted to broaden that, recognizing that there are going to be a number of children with autism come through our system. We're looking at training as a program to get our counselor skill level up. And we recently have met with the Department of Ed, seniors and persons with disabilities, and ourselves to develop a working group to really look at ensuring greater access to services and outcomes for all children transitioning from special education. There's also a unique challenge with adults who have exited the system and really aren't linked necessarily to a service program that we're trying to address.
I'm sure if I can follow, please. Yeah, the issue of high-functioning autism isn't really a transition from special ed to something. It's a question of, well, both in the school systems dealing with high-functioning autism, but also the the transition, both into college and into work. And it's, I mean, it's not the mental retardation issue, it's the social functions that are usually the huge problem, social and language functions for people who have a lot of capacity. And I think the commission is concerned that increasing the bandwidth is pretty important. So I'd be happy to stay in touch with you as this goes on, but I think it's something. I mean, we're facing this autism tsunami. We're now 1 in 80 kids diagnosed with autism, and they're across all across the spectrum. So the whole picture of what autism is changing, and DOE hasn't quite got the message yet. So I don't think you can rely on them for help.
I'm glad you're following up on that.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you so much, Stephanie. We're going to let you move on.
Okay. Go back in a minute. This is where we are.
We undertook a number of strategic improvement efforts in 2009, 2010, and moving forward into this year. Enhancing employment outcomes has been a significant effort for us. We want to increase our employment outcomes by increasing and improving the quality of job developers while driving down the costs. We've trained 177 job developers on a curriculum developed for us by a job development specialist. It's resulted in 307 additional job placements and a 28% reduction in the cost per placement. The Work Incentive Network is a program that we are doing in partnership with Disability Rights Oregon and the independent living centers around the state. It provides benefits planning services to recipients of Social Security disability benefits so they can understand that they can go to work. That there are ways that they can keep medical benefits, which is a significant issue for them and has been a barrier to going to work. We just completed our first round evaluation to see how we've done in the first 9 months. We have 132 individuals who started working after receiving benefits counseling. We have 52 who increased their hours and earnings. And we have 230 individuals who've chosen to stay employed after talking with a benefits counselor. These are all folks who have not gone back onto publicly funded benefits or who have been able to either eliminate or reduce their reliance on those benefits. We've talked briefly about Project Access. We're working primarily in the Eugene area with five local schools. We currently have 244 students with disabilities enrolled in the project, though we're actually serving about twice that number because of the kinds of classrooms that we're on. Finally, the Ticket to Work is a Social Security sponsored incentive program to get folks off their rolls, quite frankly. And it incents providers to do that work. We have partnered with 11 community mental health programs to coordinate our resources and services to assist individuals with severe and persistent mental illness go to work. We've assigned 38 tickets, and what those tickets will bring to us are benchmark payments as those people secure and maintain employment. We have 8 people in pay status. Ticket also provides for cost reimbursement to OVRS for the services we provide individuals who are able to go to work and get off of Social Security benefits. And we were able to recoup about $7 million from the Social Security Administration for the individuals we assisted to go to work.
Oh, yes, Representative.
Hi, thanks, Madam Chair. Right before you went into Ticket to Work, I think you said
that you serve about twice that many students,
mm-hmm.
and I'm wondering who those other students are and if how they qualify to be in this program.
We are providing this program in cooperation with local school districts in special ed classrooms. In some instances, these are resource classes where I think there are both kids with issues related to disadvantagement as well as special education.
Follow up?
Let's keep going.
Okay.
So I'm just going to file this away,
sure.
Trying to figure out where these different pots are and how people get assigned to have their coverage provided by different programs, different grants, things like that.
Somewhat confusing.
It is to me.
Yes, to me too.
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Harker, if I may just for a moment. I think what this project doesn't represent financial assistance to any particular individual, and I just want to make that clear. It's a training-based project that's in classrooms, and I think what Stephanie's pointing out is that although the students with disabilities who are enrolled in the program number 244, the classrooms that we're providing the training in include other students, and so there are other groups of students benefiting from the kinds of life skills training and other trainings and assessment projects that are being provided as part of the training effort. So I don't know if that helps at all with where you were headed in terms of your question, but it's just to be clear that these students aren't receiving a financial benefit. They're receiving some assistance through a training-based program.
Okay, thanks. It does help.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think as we're moving forward here in the fiscal reality we're in,
sure.
How do we continue to deliver services to all of these folks? And to do that, my head wants to know where all the streams of money are coming from, and while there is not money going to those individuals, there is money going to pay for the program at some level.
Absolutely.
So I'm trying to think of how we keep these things covered. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. Go ahead.
In response to self-identified areas in need of improvement and findings from a recent Secretary of State audit, we've developed a strategic improvement plan. We're utilizing project management and other lean daily management tools to implement this plan. We're focusing our improvement efforts on reducing the median cost per case by 20% by, that should be 2011. We are automating compliance reviews, which will strengthen our ability to ensure consumer compliance with mutually identified benchmarks and employment plans. Currently, those compliance reviews are done by hand. We've made significant revisions to our policy manual in order to standardize practice and performance expectations for our counselors. We are using our computer case management system to generate vendor report cards. This will give us an annual idea of performance, and this information will figure into the renewal of contracts with those providers. We've enhanced our case file reviews by requiring mandatory monthly supervisory reviews of files, and we've moved to a performance-based contract with our job developers.
And just for the record, members of the committee, Erin Killen-Steele, I did want to point out we give you a copy of our strategic improvement project update. This is how we, is it biweekly?
Yes.
We biweekly keep check on ourselves and our progress around these strategic improvement efforts, and it'll give you a sense of some of our, this is part of our continuous improvement effort as a division as we're identifying, you know, who's responsible for which efforts to be more efficient and effective and what the timelines are for those. And then you can see the status. We did not give you a color copy, but when you open it on your computer, you can see where we're green, yellow, where we're making progress according to our timelines or maybe going too slow. And it's an indicator for Stephanie and I as leaders of the and managers of where we are. Are we making progress around these things and keeping pace with the level of improvement that we're expecting? So I wanted you to see an example of that management tool and be happy to provide it. I think you have it electronically.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick glossary check, if you will, Stephanie. Give me an example of a vendor in this context and an example of a job developer.
We use those interchangeably. A vendor in our system is simply someone that we purchase services or goods from. And a job developer would be an example of a vendor.
So they were outside the department?
They're outside of the department. We work with a number of either solo job developers or mom and dad shops. We do work with some of the larger programs, you know, the Goodwills, the Gardens.
Okay. Good. That's helpful. Thank you.
In conclusion, VR is part of the continuum of supports helping Oregonians with disabilities become employed and maximize their independence. Through our Work Incentive Network and our Partnership Plus, we can help reduce the need for public assistance through educating individuals about benefits, keeping them employed, or helping them obtain employment. We are actively engaged in our efforts to educate employers about the benefits of hiring people with disabilities. And Oregon's economic development strategy coming out of this recession should include consideration of job development and employment strategies for disadvantaged, chronically unemployed, vulnerable adults, and persons with disabilities.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Stephanie. Really appreciate the presentation. Any quick questions? Erin, I'm a little concerned. We have four bills that we're supposed to hear today. I think my preference would be to hear those bills and then see if we have time to hear from you regarding the child welfare.
Okay.
Kath, is that okay
sure,
with you?
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you again,
thank
Stephanie.
You.
So I'm going to briefly close the informational meeting and open up a public hearing, and we're going to hear House Bill 2047. Jennifer.
Chair Tomei and Gilliam, committee members, House Bill 2047 designates private residential boarding schools that provide academic education and therapeutic care as a child-caring agency, subject to the licensure requirements of the Department of Human Services. The designation would enable the Department of Human Services to immediately remove children at risk of harm without an initial hearing.
Thank you very much. And we have Donna Keddie?
Yes.
Oh,
hi
Donna.
Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, I am, for the record, Donna Keddie. I'm the manager of residential treatment and licensing for children, adults, and families with the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2047. And, you know, the reason that we support this bill is that it will fold within the existing private child caring agency statute the ability for us to have licensing authority over therapeutic boarding schools. So currently we have two statutes that give us the authority to govern. One is for academic boarding schools, and the other is for all of the other private child caring agencies. I think at the time that the statutes were written, I don't think the therapeutic boarding school existed as it currently does. The intent of academic boarding school statute was to regulate basically boarding schools that where the primary function was education for children in a 24-hour-a-day setting. The therapeutic boarding school emerged over time and it serves, although it's primarily for the education of children, It serves youth who have conditions that cause them to be far more vulnerable than a regular school population. Over the course of the last biennium, we've had some events that have occurred in therapeutic boarding schools that are of safety concern. And so we support this bill to give us the ability to fold therapeutic boarding schools under the private child caring agency statute, which will enable us to be more vigilant and to allow those facilities to be more vigilant to protect vulnerable children who have elevated safety concerns and issues by virtue of their behavioral, mental health, potentially alcohol and drug conditions.
Does the state pay for any of these, or are these all privately funded?
Co-Chair Tomei, the current five therapeutic boarding schools that exist in Oregon are all privately funded.
Thank you.
Children.
Yeah. Thank you.
So it will give us an ability to, under the current academic boarding school statute, therapeutic boarding schools, we have an inability to take immediate action when there is an unsafe condition in those schools because they fall under an academic statute. If this particular body were folded under the private child caring agency statute, we could take more immediate corrective action, like immediate notice of suspension prior to hearing. As it currently exists, academic boarding schools have the ability to have a hearing prior to us issuing an immediate suspension notice. So it doesn't enable the department to protect the health and safety needs of this more vulnerable population. I am here in support of the bill, and I thank you for the opportunity to present, and I open to any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Kenny. Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the bill, line 14 and 15, has residential care, including but not limited to foster care or residential treatment for children. What, and you add D to it, which is more explicit, but why wouldn't this include agencies, residential care in combination with academic education? Anything that you're adding in the next two lines?
Co-Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Greenwood, the academic boarding school statute really doesn't allow us to take that immediate action. The private child caring agency statute does. And so the private child caring agency statute is the full gamut of facilities across the state. And there are approximately 230-some facilities where we have that ability to intervene. The therapeutic schools are more closely aligned in the kind of population they serve to that particular group.
Well, let me ask the question a different way.
Okay.
It seems to me that D is included in C as the statute is currently written. C is residential care, including but not limited to foster care or residential treatment for children, the current statute's definition.
Members of the committee, for the record, Erin Kelly Seal, the Children, Adults, and Families Division Administrator. Representative Greenlick, I think we've had legal interpretation otherwise. The difference is the primary focus of the facility. When the facility comes to us to be licensed, they indicate to us the kind of license that they are seeking. And before now, facilities who would consider themselves primarily educational but also then have a therapeutic component to them have applied primarily under the therapeutic boarding school and academic boarding school license setting, which has fewer restrictions to it. Entities that consider themselves primarily therapeutic apply under the opposite set of statutes, and there is then a requirement that they provide educational opportunities for children in their setting when they are residential-based setting. So I think the issue is that. I just wanted to add that as part of the context for the need to just be sure that we're being explicit in law, and we've been advised that legally, because of the way that facilities come to us and say this is the kind of license that we want, our hands are more tied around a facility who is licensed as a therapeutic boarding school.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up. Has the legal advice been offered in response to challenges from facilities? And if so, what were those like, if I may? And I don't. I'm educating myself here.
Absolutely.
And if
it's in it,
that's
what we're here
Let's go.
Co-chairs and Representative Harker. This past year, we had some very serious allegations of abuse in one of our therapeutic boarding schools, which it was then our obligation as the licensing entity to respond to as they were under investigation by our Office of Investigations and Training, which is separate from the Children, Adults, and Families Division in DHS. As part of that process, we learned a lot about what our legal rights or authority that we had around the regulation of facilities. These therapeutic boarding schools serve large numbers of kids, and the allegations of abuse in this case were very serious. And we were, our ability to intervene, to provide notice to parents in the facility, even though, yes, they are private pay, about what the school was under investigation for, what the concerns were, and our ability to take action and be on site and actively involved as the investigation was proceeding was very limited. And so we learned through that process what some of the limitations were, and we were comparing it because before this, when we were dealing with more serious issues of abuse, they actually had come through the other group had happened in settings that were licensed as residential care treatment providers, so we were more familiar with what our legal authority and the processes were there. So we were able to juxtapose the two and felt, as we got into it, looking at the kids that were being served in the allegations of and who were making the allegations of abuse, the kids really didn't look very different from many of the kids who are being served in residential settings. They were vulnerable kids who were struggling with addiction treatment issues, mental health issues. They just happened to have parents who could afford to send them to these therapeutic boarding schools, parents doing the right thing. And so we take very seriously our protection responsibility as the state and our ability then to interact with those parents so they can make informed choices about where their kids are and what's going on in that setting. And when you have a setting where a child's there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the only adult supervision is being provided by the provider, who's now under investigation, there's a vulnerability issue there that we really want parents to be able to know about, act on, and that we believe the state needs to be able to be involved with a provider to say, what can we do to help you, you know, change whatever is needed to be changed. We really don't, our primary focus around providers as a department is we believe they provide an important service to children and to families, and so we strive to keep them operating and in business as much as possible through even some really difficult events. In rare instances, we're not able to accomplish that, but we need, what we're asking for in this bill is more authority with these boarding schools that are therapeutic in nature to be able to work with them to address whatever issues they present.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Recognizing what your goal is to protect children, I don't discount that, of course, and the difficulty you may have had in incidents that we probably can't go into, I still think I'd like more of a context. And I'm picking up five of these schools in Oregon, and you just said a growing number of children in these schools. Give me a context of how big this area of education is. Is it growing? How many incidents, roughly, that you faced that tied your hands like you just suggested? I just want to get an idea where the trend is and how big of a problem this is for you all.
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, it is a small number of schools currently. It's just emerged over the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years, so it's anticipated to be a growing market and a growing population. Some of these schools, they vary in size. The one that Aaron referenced, I think, had 60 or so children living there. As far as the number of allegations of abuse that emerge, they're few, and I can get you an exact number over a specified period of time if you'd like that. But as this population, as this particular kind of school continues to grow, and as we've seen issues within it, we are the only oversight body. So we are on site every 2 years, which isn't very often when you have a population that is becoming, from at least anecdotally and from our vantage point, the students that are being admitted are more and more vulnerable. They have, they're admitting kids with greater difficulties. So we have had some experience with a safety concern, and we anticipate that the population will grow and our concern will grow.
And Co-Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, Co-Chair Gilliam, apologies. We're not trying to be coy, and in fact our circumstance this last year was very publicly exposed. It involved Mount Bachelor Academy in Central Oregon. There were many articles written about it. And so if you would like to just go back and look at some of the things, I think our intent here was not to point a finger at a particular entity. But this particular set of circumstances was very much part of the public conversation.
Do we have any other folks testifying on this bill?
No.
Quick question. I noticed there's no revenue impact. And anytime you expand authority and anytime a group like this is growing, I think there will be an economic impact, perhaps not in this cycle, but I want to make sure we're not missing something there. And the second thing is, how do we communicate with this group in relationship to this bill? There's no one here to testify on the other side, so to speak. Can you say a little bit about that?
Co-Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, we will be happy to solicit any input from each of the providers of these services if that's something that is wanted. We have communicated with the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs about this bill, and they have some intersect with some, I believe, some of the folks that this would impact. So there is awareness of the bill. We've communicated with Disability Rights Oregon regarding the bill, and they've been very involved in some of our activities with the therapeutic boarding schools over the last couple of years. And then we have an open rule writing process. So we would invite, and have in the past regarding all of our rules, invite participation from the therapeutic boarding school administration. So that is something that we have done and will continue to do.
So maybe we need to continue the hearing and get some of this more information. And I don't know if it's feasible for you, Jennifer. Can you find on the internet, because I remember there was a lot about this Mount Bachelor, and find the information that was sent to us, because I remember reading about this and being very concerned, and I think once the committee does, you'll see why it's important that we do pass this legislation, I believe. So that would be really helpful. And so we will continue this at another time if we get enough information that the committee feels comfortable with. Thank you so much. So I'm going to be closing the public hearing on 2047 and opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2050.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, committee members, House Bill 2050 amends and aligns the state statutory language for children who remain in child welfare custody to current federal statutory language. It removes the term permanent foster care as an option for an out-of-home placement for award in the substitute care of the Department of Human Services. It clarifies another planned permanent living arrangement as a permanency plan option for award in substitute care.
Thank you. And we do have one person signed up, and that's Kevin George. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George, and I work as the Foster Care Program Manager at the Department of Human Services. I'm here today in support of House Bill 2050, and as Committee Administrator adequately reported, what we're looking at is a technical change here in statute. What this technical change will do is actually provide clarity for our field offices and the courts and other folks around permanency issues for children. The federal government actually allows five different permanency options for children. So those are children who are in foster care, and we are to seek some permanency for them, a permanent family. Where are they going to grow up? And so that first goal is to really look at reunification. Can these children get home with their families if at all possible? And if not, then we are to seek out options for adoption, guardianship, or permanent placement with relatives, or then a new federal definition is in another planned permanent living arrangement. And what that's caused over time is an acronym of APLA. And so folks, historically over the last couple, 2 or 3 years where this has been out, has been confused with Oregon statute where we have permanent foster care in the statute, we have planned permanent living arrangement, and then we have a federal language called another planned permanent living arrangement. So we're trying to bring all these things into a line and say there's one definition here and here's what it means. Within the APLA statute, we actually have administrative rules that provide guidance for us on this, and permanent foster care will continue to exist within that set of administrative rules. So for some young people who are in a permanent foster care setting now, where a foster family has committed to raise this child until the age of majority, they will be able to continue doing that. What we're looking to do is clarifying why go into permanent foster care if we can take the next step to a guardianship or to adoption. So in summary, this really is a technical change to the statute at this point in time, and so we request your consideration and support of House Bill 2050, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. George. Any questions? Representative Greenlee.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Questioning.
It looks like this takes permanent foster care out of the statute. Am I just, does it come out in one place and in another? I know the LCs like to do that.
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlee, it actually does take permanent foster care out of the statute. By the federal regulations, permanent foster care is a subgroup of APLA, of another planned permanent living arrangement.
I got you.
So that's what we're trying to do is line it up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Any other questions? Oh.
I'm having a problem with this because I like the term permanent foster care. I know what that means. Reading this, I can see all kinds of things in this. I mean, it's a slippery slope. I don't understand. Can you talk about the other plan? I said another planned permanent living. What are some other planned permanent living arrangements that this covers? And I don't want to lose permanent foster care, because I think there's a place for that.
Yes. Co-chairs and Representative Thompson, thank you for the question. Indeed, we are not losing permanent foster care. It remains in Oregon administrative rules as a subgroup of another planned permanent living arrangement. And for the record, I don't like that terminology either, but that's what the federal government, until they put me in charge of that, we were going to have APLA. The reality is, though, that APLA will include other kinds of things, such as there are some young people who, for whatever situation within their family structure, they may need to be in a facility. They may need to be in a group home where somebody who may want to adopt them or be a permanent resource for them just cannot care for them. So we have situations where somebody may be their permanent person and be that permanent supportive adult for them, but they will never parent them because of that child's disabilities or the limitations that person has. So those would also be an APLA plan. So there's actually two different categories within the APLA. One is our permanent foster care and administrative rules, and the other one is for those very unique situations. Sometimes there's a developmental disability child, and we still may have permanent people connected to them, but they're not parenting, and so those go in under an APLA plan as well. So those for very unique situations of those. We will not be losing our permanent foster care. We continue to have it. We continue to update the rules. We just did in December of this last year as well. It is definitely necessary for many of our, for some of our children.
And we won't be downgrading that. I fear in regulation that we, and not, I'm not pointing a finger at your agency, but we write regulations for these kind of changes only to find out that what we downgraded by doing it doesn't exist 3 years from now because we're off into something else. I mean, I can see reason to have another planned permanent living arrangement, mm-hmm. and I can see a reason to have that listed right next to permanent foster care. Mm-hmm. I'm having a little bit of problem of just kind of obscuring. I trust what you say that it's in there, but I don't see it in there. when I read this, I don't see permanent foster care.
Co-chairs and Representative Thompson, you're absolutely correct. This does remove it from the statute. It continues to be in our administrative rules. Again, as we write administrative rules, that's an open process. We have feedback. We have comments. It continues to be there. What we actually have done, instead of actually watering it down, is actually raised the bar on permanent foster care, where we do not allow any longer for a caseworker and a foster parent just to make that decision on their own. They have to go through administrative approval and get approval from managers. There's increased accountability on those placements as well. So it's not the permanent foster care that happened 10, 12 years ago, where a child would get to permanent foster care and then we'd all kind of wash our hands and say that child's fine there till they're 18. We maintain face-to-face contact requirements, maintain some compliance with the foster home. All those things are still in place. So we've actually raised the bar on the accountability of permanent foster care as we've gone along this, because we do believe there is a role and there is a need for our children to have permanent foster care options.
And if I might suggest, if we do take this to a work session, we can state here that we are intending to keep planned foster care. Permanent foster care, correct. So we can make.
I just like the goal of permanency,
right,
for these kids, because a lot of them languish for long periods of time nationally, not just in Oregon.
Right.
And another planned permanent living arrangement is, to me, very nebulous.
It is very vague, right?
Yeah.
Right. So we can state that on the record that this is what we're expecting if we do have a work session. Right. Thank you for your question.
Co-chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry. If I may, and Representative Thompson, the part of where we're going with this, too, is that as we really get into, again, I'm from the old school of doing permanent foster care for a longer years, getting to really looking at and dissecting, is permanent foster care permanent? And the reality is it's not for many of these children. So there's a plan of permanent foster care, and we all feel good about that, but the reality is some of their needs continue to be there, or families aren't able to continue caring for them, and so they are cycling in the system still with a permanent foster care plan. So part of ours is to increase the accountability to make sure when we are making that decision, it's the right decision, and we all know that. And it's accountable to everybody, but not to make it so easy that people move to that and then walk away without providing that. So it's a finer group of children that will actually be there, and believe at this point in time, it is one of those commitments that we've got as a department, and be happy to send you the administrative rules we have on that so you can actually see there are some issues here to take care of. So I appreciate the concern.
That would be very helpful. You can send it on to Jennifer, and she'll pass it along
Absolutely.
To the rest of us. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, ma'am. Would an amendment that said permanent foster care was included in that definition of another, would that settle what Representative Thompson was worried about? You're saying that is included, is it?
Co-chairs and Representative Greenlick, it is included in the administrative rules we have. So the statute basically just outlines what those permanency options are for children, that we have the federal government saying, here's what those permanency options are, we're accountable to them. We then actually write administrative rules that actually govern how we actually implement the statute, and within those rules we actually have the permanent foster care. So the permanent foster care is there, it's alive and well, it's existing within the administrative rules rather than our goal of in statute.
And your concern is that after we're gone, somebody else may interpret it that way, is that?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about legislative intent, we deleted permanent foster care by this action and didn't include it in the new definition. And it would seem to me, if it was intended to be included in the new definition, then it wouldn't hurt to have a brief amendment to the definition of additional permanent to include but not limited to permanent foster care. I mean, if that would make Representative Thompson feel more comfortable about it.
Representative Thompson.
Maybe if I phrase the question a different way. We have another planned permanent living arrangement. What are the planned permanent living arrangements other than another one? I assume adoption is one of them.
One. Correct. Adoptions, co-chairs, and Representative Thompson. The other permanency options are adoptions and guardianship, permanent placement with relatives, and then the last and least preferred is the another planned permanent living arrangement, of which, by the federal statute, permanent foster care is implied within that category as a subgroup.
Now, I mean, one of my really big issues for a long time, and you know it, are foster care arrangements where these kids are in 7 to 19 different foster homes, you know, in 72 different school districts for God knows how long, and permanency is really big with me. You know, I understand the problems you have, but it's, you know, we got to get toward that end of the spectrum somehow.
And Representative Thompson, I think that's exactly what we're trying to get to here, is provide some clarity as to folks so they know here's what we're doing, and again, really raising the bar not only on the Child Welfare Agency, but on the courts, on the attorneys, on costs, all the players at the table. We all know what we're going into, and we're all then committed to actually support that plan, whatever that is.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sure, yeah, I'm getting more troubled by what you're saying rather than less troubled. In the SMS, it says the purpose is to remove permanent foster care as an option for out-of-home placement of wards and substitute care of your department. I mean, yeah, when somebody's looking at legislative intent, it's going to be hard to hear you say that's not what we're doing when this sounds like a piece of legislative intent. And if it is not what you intend to do, then I would suggest you ought to get an amendment that makes clear that's not what you're intending to do.
If I can respond to that, Representative Greenleck, it says federal statutory language does not recognize permanent foster care as a legal option. And so that's in the background under the SMS. So it seems to me that all that the agency is trying to do is coordinate our language with federal language. Is that accurate?
Chair, to make correct. That's exactly what we're trying to do here.
So I think if we state that this is our intent in coordinating the federal language with the Oregon language, but our intent is to maintain the permanent foster care.
Maybe let me ask the question differently then. If you delete permanent foster care from this statute, what statutory authority do you have to include it on a regulatory basis? Where is your statutory authority to
it? Co-chairs and Representative Greenleck, the statutory authority then would be under another planned permanent living arrangement. As we're adding that in as a definition, that's exactly where the permanent foster care lives and breathes, is under that category.
Okay. Oh, Representative Thompson.
Under the attempt to standardize the language of the federal government, is there any reason that Oregon can't have permanent foster care?
Co-chairs and
Are we being encouraged not to have it by the federal government?
Right.
Or not to call it that?
Right. Representative Thompson, it is not one way or another. I can certainly provide the federal law so you can actually see what that says. They only recognize five options: okay. The reunification, the adoption, the guardianship, the relative care, or another planned permanent living arrangement. And so for us, we always have to make sure we're tying it towards that, and that's exactly, it's one of the categories of another planned permanent living arrangement.
The extension of that is, can we not have 10 options in Oregon, recognizing five of them are federal? To what degree are we bound by what federal wants us to do, other than probably a check?
Right. Co-chairs and
I understand funding.
Representative Thompson, that's exactly where we're going to follow the money at some point in time, is that we are bound to have permanency options. We report on these to them regularly. They get tied into our Title IV-E federal funding, and those are their options. So we have these subcategories we can do. If we get too many, my belief was if we get too many within the statute, and again, historically, as we all at some point in time leave our current positions and people lose the history of this, mm-hmm. we may start really find ourselves out of compliance at some point in time.
Aaron, you wanted to weigh in as an attorney, I would assume. Any legal language you need to work on here?
Echo Chair is Erin Kelly, CLCAP Director, and I can't represent myself here today as an attorney, although I am one, but I'm not functioning as the attorney to the department. I think there are a couple of things, and I do appreciate Representative Thompson's concerns and Representative Greenwich's point about the amendment. One is, from an overarching policy framework, our state has committed to an agenda that says that if children don't need to be in foster care, they shouldn't be. And I know that's something you support. And one of the things we've done, as Kevin mentioned, is we started looking at our data as compared to other states. And we have a really high number of kids that Oregon has relegated into a permanent foster care / APLA category, higher than most states, too many. And we're uncomfortable with that. That flies in the face of a statement that says children should not be in foster care forever. They should be there temporarily. Part of what our discussion's been over the course of the last biennium is, what is it that we need to be doing from a strategic standpoint to reduce the number of kids who are permanently committed to being away from somebody who's committed to loving them forever? In some instances, foster parents step up and they say, I will do that. And we strongly support and value our foster parent community. We could not do this work without them. They are incredibly important to us and to the safety of our children. But as you point out, Representative Thompson, what has happened is we look deeper into that category of kids that are currently labeled as, we in Oregon, our courts end up relegating it to sort of a slash approach. They say APLA / permanent foster care. When we look at those kids, they don't stay in one foster home. They move. And part of that is, we believe, there are a lot of reasons for that, but that happens less often when someone commits to a guardianship, to adoption, or with relatives. When we talked about this law, we had a long conversation with the courts, with attorneys. We've been circulating this bill for quite a many months to make sure that people were comfortable that this fit within the strategic goals that we have as a state and that our courts have signed up to say, we support you, DHS, because no child enters or exits foster care without the authority of a court order. And they said to us, they voiced some of the same concerns that Representative Thompson has said, and then we reminded them as experts in the law that they still are bound to federal law and that federal law includes permanent foster care as an option. They just happen to name it something different. And I agree the name is not quite as obvious on its face as the name permanent foster care. But for us, this bill was about two major things. It was about bringing our language into compliance with the federal language so that we wouldn't create confusion among courts, new attorneys, foster parents or others about what the options are. We understood we weren't changing substantively the fact that there would be the option of permanent foster care. But the second thing, and this is more symbolic, and we had this conversation with many people, is we would like for people not to look at Oregon's law and see on its face that permanent foster care is something we believe is okay for kids. We would like to have the ranking more clearly defined, as Kevin has articulated, that our first priority is to get kids home. And we do that over 60% of the time. And if we can't do that, we want kids to be adopted or in guardianships or with their relatives. And we wanted then that last option as a caveat. We want it to be more of an exception than the rule. And today, it's not quite the exception that we wish it was. So I think, you know, whatever clarification that you believe we need to make in terms of defining what it is we're trying to do and what intent you support, we'd be happy to do that. But I can assure you, because of the federal definition of APLA, our state law, because it says APLA, will continue to include permanent foster care as a state law alternative.
Okay. That helps a lot. It helped me a lot.
Yeah, is Representative Thompson agreeing?
Representative Thompson, are you agreeing that this helps?
Yes,
great.
That would make a rather long amendment, but if we could just insert her response to it.
Well, can I suggest that...
I just like clarity.
Yes. Yeah. That if there are issues that you either contact Aaron or Kevin and offline, and then maybe we can clarify this, because it sounds like this is something that the department does need and should happen.
And Chair, I'm quite comfortable after that
explanation.
Yeah.
You are too?
I am too, yeah.
Okay, good. Anybody else have issues? Terrific. Thank you
so much.
Appreciate that. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. And I will open up the public. And thank you, Representative Clem. Thank you for
being here.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just your co-chair came to my committee the other day, and I didn't know why, and he sat down. And he stayed for a long time, so I thought I would return the favor, maybe.
Sometimes he was not in the wrong room. I'm supposed sure to be.
This is out of order on your left.
With that, we will open the hearing, a public hearing on House Bill 2050. And we have 2051. Thank you. I'm going to close 50 and open up 51. Close House Bill 2050 and open up House Bill 2051. Okay, and we have Catherine Prouty and Lois Day.
I'm sorry, are we going to 51?
51.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam and committee members, House Bill 2051 provides that the Department of Human Services determines the qualifications for and sets the adoption payment amount through negotiations with prospective adoptive parents. It allows for modification of the payment amount upon a change in circumstance or in the amount of comparable assistance in foster care. Clarifies when the department may suspend or terminate payments to the adoptive parents, establishes the right to a hearing for those affected by decisions of the department, and removes the requirements to annually redetermine adoption assistance subsidies and the ability to make discretionary adjustments to those subsidies by the department.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Tomei, Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lois Day. I'm the administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children within CAF. And I'm here today actually not to offer testimony, but to formally introduce Kathy Prouty as our new adoption program manager in the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children. This is her first time testifying, and I want to make sure the committee had a formal introduction, because I'm certain you'll be seeing her more as the session progresses.
Thank you, Lois, and welcome, Kathy.
Thank you. Good morning. Co-Chair Tomei, Co-Chair Gilliam, and members of the committee, for the record, I am Catherine Prouty, and I'm the Adoption Program Manager for the Office of Safety and Permanency, and we are part of the Children, Adults, and Families Division of the Department of Human Services. And I am here today to testify in support of House Bill 2051, which would bring Oregon Revised Statute into compliance with federal law. And before I discuss the bill, I'd like to just give you a very brief description of adoption assistance. And adoption assistance refers to financial subsidies and medical coverage granted to an adopted family of an eligible child. And it's for the purpose of offsetting the cost of that adoption and of meeting the needs of that child. And the adoption assistance subsidy amount is determined through a negotiation between the adoptive family and the department. It's called an adoptive assistant agreement, and it's based on the special needs of the child, and it's based on the circumstances of the family that may impact their ability to meet the needs of the child. So currently, under Oregon statute, the department is required to do annual redeterminations of adoption assistance eligibility. And under the current Oregon Revised Statute, the department has the ability to increase, decrease, or terminate the adoption subsidy at will, at the discretion of the department. And federal law does not require annual redeterminations of adoption assistance eligibility. And federal law also requires that changes in the subsidy is through mutual agreement between the adoptive family and the department, and it's based on the changing needs of the child or the changing circumstances of the family. So the result of the current statute is that the department mails annual redetermination notices to all families who receive adoption assistance, and that is approximately 11,000 families. And the families are required to then notify the department of any changes in the special needs of their child or in their circumstances. And the notifications offer or suggest that the family has the ability to ask for an increase in their subsidy payment. And we believe that that does lead to an increase in requests to redetermine a subsidy amount. It would be a workload decrease with this House bill, because we do believe that the redetermination requests would go down. There is a small fiscal decrease in the cost of the annual mailings.
Thank you for the ability to testify in support of House Bill 2051, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Kathy. Great presentation. Any questions? Pretty straightforward, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, I see that there is a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and what I'm hearing you say that there will be a possible workload decrease, and so it would still go to Ways and Means, is that correct? Does anyone know? You don't think it will?
I don't think it will.
Okay, terrific. That's what I like to hear. Thank you. Any questions? All right.
Do we have the revenue impact statement?
We have the Representative Greenlick. We have the revenue. We do not have the fiscal. It's been requested, but we have not received it yet.
But my assumption is that the fiscal comes in with no fiscal impact, then we can request a rescission of the...
Be rescinded from the referral to Ways and Means. Right.
Representative, or co-chair.
Yes.
You had a question?
I do not.
Oh, I thought you put up your little hand. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
One question, please.
Yes, of course.
A clarification on the annual review. The parents still do have the right, if circumstances change, to request an adjustment or review?
Co-chairs Tomei and Gilliam, Representative Thompson, at any time a family has the ability to request a redetermination.
And how do they know they have that?
It is stated in their adoption assistance agreement.
Okay.
All right. Thank you again. Nice job, Kathy. Thank you, Lois. With that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2051 and open up a hearing on House Bill 2052, which also has an amendment.
Chairs Tomei and Gilliam, committee members, House Bill 2052, the original bill, expands the definition of child for the purposes of payments for adoption assistant subsidies by the Department of Human Services. It requires the department to pay non-recurring adoption expenses in adoptions for children with special needs. It clarifies the limits on payments to adoptive parents and allows adoption assistance subsidies to continue until the age of 21 for young adult adoptees who have finalized adoptions after the age of 16 and before the age of 18, provided they are engaged in specific academic or vocational preparation programs or meet eligibility criteria and have disabilities preventing them from independence at the age of 18. It also requires parents receiving adoption payments to inform the department of circumstances affecting their eligibility. As Chair Tomei indicated, we did receive yesterday a -1 amendment, and that amendment modifies the operative date of the Act to October 1st, 2011, and it allows the Department of Human Services to adopt rules or take action prior to the operative date in their performance of duties, functions, and powers, and also declares an emergency taking effect upon passage.
Read the background also, would you please, Jennifer?
Certainly. Modification of state statutory language allows Department of Human Services to take advantage of federal laws which provide for additional federal funding options for foster care, guardianship, or adoption assistance subsidies continuation until the age of 21. Federal law requires all three options be implemented simultaneously. Departmental records indicate during the past 5 federal fiscal years, 68 children were adopted at age 16 or older.
Thank you very much. Kathy Ronigan.
Thank you. Representative Tomei, Representative Gilliam, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Catherine Prouty. I'm the Adoption Program Manager for the Office of Safety and Permanency, and we are part of the Children, Adults, and Families Division. And I am here to testify on behalf of House Bill 2052. So Oregon statute currently provides that adoption assistance subsidies must end when the youth reaches the age of 18, and that's regardless of the circumstance of that youth. House Bill 2052 would allow the department to extend subsidy payments for eligible children up to the age of 21. And the eligibility requirements are that the youth is adopted after the age of 16, and upon reaching their 18th birthday, the youth is either attending high school in a post-secondary education program, in vocational training, or has disabilities that prevents them from achieving independence at the age of 18. In the past five federal fiscal years, there's been approximately 60 youth that potentially meet this eligibility requirement. These youth were adopted after the age of 16. But the impact of the bill is that we would be able to receive a federal 4E match for the eligible youth that would receive the increased adoption subsidy, and we would be able to receive and be eligible for a 4E match for foster youth who stay in care to the age of 21 and guardianship assistant youth who receive guardianship subsidies to the age of 21. The department already provides foster care payments for youth who stay in foster care to the age of 21. This represents about 500 youth, and with the exception of a small population, that is general fund monies that pay for that population of foster care youth. The federal law requires that if to receive the 4E match, we would have to extend the payments for all three of the populations, the adoption assistance youth, the foster youth, and the guardianship assistance youth. We do believe that extending support to the age of 21 is good public policy. Children are shown to have better outcomes when they are able to remain in care for a longer period of time. They have increased supports, and they're afforded a better opportunity to have a successful transition into adulthood. The educational incentive, we think, would be impactful. It would provide an incentive for families to support the ongoing education of that youth. And we also hope that it would provide an incentive for adoptive families to adopt older youth who are much more difficult to find adoptive homes for. We also believe that House Bill 2052 makes good financial sense for Oregon. It is a cost-neutral bill because it does allow us to draw down federal funds for a population of children that we, up to this point, have not been able to do so. As we increase the subsidy payments to a particular population, then we're able to draw down funds for the foster care population as well. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Kathy.
And co-chairs, if I may, one of the things, this is Erin Kelly Seal, Children, Adults, and Families Director, and one of the things that Kathy had counted on was I had counted on as well was that she would benefit from our overview prior to the bill.
Right.
So one thing I did want to mention around this bill is that it is, again, an extension of our efforts to safely and equitably reduce the number of kids in foster care. We currently pay, I think I just want to underscore, because I know it sounds like we're growing the number of children who would receive adoption assistance. In fact, we would hope to do that, but we already are paying for these kids with 100% general fund in many instances because our law allows them to stay in foster care up to that age. So again, in talking with our partners in the judicial branch, attorneys, foster parents, and others, and relatives, many said, wow, we would adopt if we knew that we could count on some additional financial help. We wouldn't have to have these children in foster care so long. So we could go back and we could change court orders, and instead we would be able to negotiate adoption assistance agreements and also be bringing in federal match so that we wouldn't be spending 100% general fund on those children. So we believe that and what that means is there would no longer be state oversight of that placement. Families would be free of government intervention in their lives, but they would continue to have whatever support they need to meet the special needs of their children. And that child would have permanency, consistent with the conversation earlier about really adoption and guardianship being a more permanent option for a child than foster care.
Thank you so much, Erin.
You don't need to comment on this today, but it just keeps coming up in my mind, the relationship to the federal government. It has so much to do with everything we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Matching up semantically so that it's easier for the department to do their job. But, of course, the bigger issue for me is the funding. And I wouldn't want to in any way punish the department or hamstring them. But you might want to, when we do the overview, Erin, talk a little bit about your relationship to the federal government and the reality of the money that we're talking about for this program or any other. Because I'm all for taking advantage of money that we can take advantage of, but for how long? I mean, I have major questions, as I'm sure all of us do, about the federal government's ability to continue to fund programs in this area or any other area that Oregon takes advantage of. So I just, at least our focus is far more individual driven. We're here to look at folks where the rubber meets the road, but we cannot afford to act as if the federal faucet will stay on. So I just want to at least put that on the record and have it as a context for going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or even the state faucet.
Did you have a question, Representative?
No, I was just saying, or even the state faucet.
Oh.
Both those faucets are, I think, in serious jeopardy that
you're right.
We need to pay real attention.
Absolutely. Any questions of either of these witnesses? So thank you so much.
Thank
I appreciate you coming to testify today. And I think that's all of our bills that we're hearing, right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And, Aaron, I would like to continue. I can't remember what our schedule is like for next week, but I would like to have you come back. So, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2052. And I want to continue the informational meeting with Aaron Kelly Seal. How do we do that so that she can come back next week and finish up her informational hearing?
Actually, we can carry the informational hearing over, but Aaron is scheduled to come back on Monday anyway to talk about self-sufficiency and TANF programs.
Okay.
So she will be here, but we can carry over the informational so that we won't have to be noticed again on the agenda.
Okay, can we do that? And I noticed two of our pretty new people aren't here today, and I really would like them to hear the information that you will be providing. So even though we have a half hour now, if it's okay with you to come back, would that be all right?
Of course.
Okay. Anything else for the good of the order here? Okay. All right. Then, is there anything else? Anything else, Mr. Chair? Then I will close the House Committee on Human Services. Thank you all for coming.
Do we have a caucus?